right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. Once again, let there be drums from Sandy Nelson. And let there be a whole hell of a lot of drums today because we got a really, I'm really looking forward to this show. At the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with Mr. Fish, okay? And if you don't know Mr. Fish, you should know Mr. Fish. And we're going to be talking with him about his debut book, Go Fish, an incredible book. Really one that just had me roaring with laughter and also just whipped my head around so many times. It's a remarkable piece of work. You're not going to want to miss that one. Before that, we'll be talking with P.Z. Myers, again, the rock god of the science world, all right? He is definitely the rock god of the science world. We'll be joining him to talk about the Large Hadron Collider, the search for the Higgs boson, and what the hell's going on with Texas Governor Rick Perry and the response, a prayer meeting of Christian fascists that Perry's sponsoring. All right, so we'll be talking with him. And opening the show up, I'm really, really happy to welcome to the show, welcome back to the show, revolutionary communist intellectual and political economist Raymond Latta. Raymond's been a guest on the show a number of times before, and today we're talking about the debt ceiling, the whole debate around that, the confrontation around that, the global crisis and savage austerity that's wrapped up in all this, and we're going to be, I guarantee you're going to be listening to something that will rock your world because you haven't really heard this kind of take on this. Raymond, welcome to the show.
Well, Michael, thanks for having me on.
Sure. Well, it's looking at this, it's really, I mean, you just did an interview in Revolution Newspaper that I thought for myself was very helpful. And I wanted to have you on the show in part to sort of dig into that and what you said there. But I also thought that there's a lot of stuff that just comes up even, you know, as you're reading that. And one thing is, and you spoke to this, you know, for a lot of people, I was looking at these numbers when this debate came on, and I'm not a chowderhead or something. You know, I look at this and I understand, and I try to dig into it and understand what's going on. But a lot of times when they start talking about this mega amount of money, it's very, very hard, I think, for people to think of. And I was thinking of my kid when he was real small, and the first time he learned about enormous numbers, and he found Googleplex. And I just looked that up last night, and I thought, all right, you know, there's a definition that says you couldn't even write that down on a piece of paper because it would take more space than the universe has to provide. And I look at the numbers they're throwing around about this debt, and you really wonder, where the hell did this come from? What is going on here? Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, again, thanks for having me on the show. And it's very interesting. Yesterday and today, the financial markets were roiled. And, you know, I think all of this speaks to the great instability, you know, that's rocking the world economy, the capitalist world economy. So we do have to look at what's going on in light of, you know, this kind of instability. Now, in terms of the debt, I mean, you're right. These are big numbers to wrap your arms around. I mean, the debt, national debt is over $14 trillion. Now, that national debt is the accumulated deficits that have built up over years of government spending. And what is it in the last few years that has really driven the deficit? And this is something that I address in my article, and people can get a hold of it, by the way, at RevCom, RevCom.us. But what's driven this huge run-up in debt over the last few years? And basically, it's three factors. Okay, the first is the downturn, the very severe downturn of the economy in 2008, 2009, and this was part of a global downturn. Now, the slowdown in economic activity, you know, created a situation where the government wasn't receiving as much revenue, and you saw the government, since it was not receiving the taxes the government normally collects, it was spending more, the government was spending more on things like extensions of unemployment benefits, food stamps, and then you had this big stimulus program of Obama, which was about $700 billion. So that's the first factor, the recession, the effects that it had on revenues coming into government, and the fact that the ruling class was trying to deal with the instabilities of this economic downturn and what effects it might have on the economy and profits, so you had that stimulus program. The second factor driving the deficits were the tax cuts dating back to early, you know, to 2001 and 2003 that were enacted by Bush. Those tax cuts limited the amount of income, the revenues coming into the government. And the third factor is military spending. America's brutal wars of conquest in Afghanistan and Iraq, and this is something I speak to in my interview, because over the last 10 years, the United States has spent over $1 trillion. Michael, talk about big numbers. $1 trillion to rain death and destruction, you know, on Iraq and Afghanistan. And that comes out right now what the U.S. is spending in Afghanistan to about $2 billion a month. So those are the three factors driving this big run-up in debt and the government deficit. The deficit represents the difference between what the government is spending and what the government is taking in. And I put a lot of emphasis on my article on what I call one of the dirty little secrets of this crisis, which is the military spending.
Go ahead, explain that. Explain what you're talking about there.
You're talking about this dirty little secret?
Yeah.
I think that's important because this was shielded from view, you know, during all the debates and deliberations and the conferees from the different House committees and this proposal and that proposal, this compromise and that. What isn't being talked about, and of course where there is no disagreement between the Republicans and the Democrats, you know, is the U.S. dominance in the world and the prosecution of these wars and the constitution and reconstitution and financing of this unprecedented military machine of the United States. Now, why I call this a dirty little secret is because if you look at the 2012 Pentagon budget, well, there's about $500 billion that's earmarked for Pentagon spending. And then you add into that what they call the special authorizations, war authorizations for Iraq and Afghanistan. And that adds in about $200 billion. So that's a total of $700 billion of formal, that is what's officially recognized as military outlays. But, you know, the budget of the United States contains all kinds of military-related and security-related spending that's not captured by the category of military spending or what the Pentagon is spending. For instance, you have the NSA, the National Security Agency, and the CIA. You have the Department of Energy, which does research on nuclear weapons development and also the disposal of aged nuclear weapons. You have the fact that the United States, when it talks about paying its past debt, that is the interest and, excuse me, the principal and the interest on past debt, well, a lot of that past debt is previous wars and weapon systems. So when you really add that up, and there was the hidden elements of the budget that are really related to the military, then you get a figure of military and security-related spending that amounts to about 40%, for anywhere from, you know, about 40% of the budget. And all of that is designed for one and one purpose only, which is to maintain U.S. dominance in the world. So as I said, this is one of the dirty little secrets of this fiscal crisis.
Mm-hmm.
The incredible amounts of money that go into building up this machine of death and destruction.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Raymond Latta, revolutionary communist intellectual and political economist. We're talking about the recent brouhaha over the national debt and the debt ceiling and all involved with that. Raymond, you know, one thing, as I'm listening to you talk and I'm thinking, all right, you're right. You know, people, that wasn't even pretended to be in the room. No one was even saying, well, we can't really, it was just not there. But what was there was a very vicious assault on people. I mean, the whole idea that people have to tighten their belts, they have to do what's best for the country, they have to, you know, it's the people who, not the military who's eating all this up, or the U.S. imperialists and their need to finance that military, but it's those, you know, slackers that basically want a free ride. They want food stamps. They want insurance. They want medical care. They want schools. This is the kind of thing that's being pumped out. That's the area that we've just gotten too flabby and fat around. That the country's gotten too flabby and fat around, in their words. And that's where we have to go. Everybody's got to tighten their belt.
Yeah, I think that's right. The grand narrative in this so-called debate, we should be clear that the debate that was taking place between the Republicans and the Democrats, you know, was a debate between two sections of the ruling class, and not a debate over whether the U.S. would, you know, seek to dominate and continue to dominate the world, or would be, you know, striving to cut back on social expenditures. It was a debate over how to do that, not whether to do that. And it's true what you say. The grand narrative of this was that government is living beyond its means, and that sections of people have become far too dependent on government, are looking for solace and handouts from the government. And all of this has begotten, you know, what the Wall Street Journal has called an entitlement culture, a culture of dependency on the government. So this was a big thematic of this debate. And, you know, you had Obama saying, look, we have to run the government the way you run your budget at home. You know, we're spending too much. And where is this spending too much coming from. It's coming from people demanding too much of the government. And there are the people who want handouts from the government. And then you have, as I said, the Wall Street Journal, which, you know, is launching this vicious ideological assault. And you have a section of the ruling class, you know, where Obama and the broad agreement that there has to be this austerity, these cuts in social spending, you have another section of the ruling class, you know, basically corresponding to these right-wing Republicans who are saying, look, we have to take down this whole idea that government has any kind of responsibility to the well-being of citizens. We have to just crack open any notion that there's any sort of social responsibility in society. So this was the grand narrative of this, you know, discussion, that we have to tighten our belts, that people are depending too much on government, and then within that you have this, you know, this theme coming from the more right-wing forces that say that, look, big government in and of itself that concerns itself with social issues is not right and must be dismantled. That is, these people just want to dismantle any semblance of government that serves any social function.
Now, you know, did you see the New York Times this morning? Where they
no, I didn't study it. I was just sort of running around. Tell me.
Well, they just they had a couple of articles. One was on the 500 points drop in the stock market, but then there was this other thing that was the disapproval rate for Congress is at a record 82% after debt talks. And one of the things that they raised was they said that more than 4 out of 5 people surveyed said that it sounds like that old TV show, right? Family Feud. More than 4 out of 5 people surveyed said the recent debt ceiling debate was more about gaining political advantage than about doing what's best for the country. Nearly 3/4 said that the debate had harmed the image of the United States in the world. You make a point throughout the article a number of times in your interview that actually there was a very real and ferocious struggle going on in the ranks of the ruling class around this, and that it was linked up to very big things happening in the world. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, well, I think that there were two sides to this, you know, narrative that was being put out. I mean, one was what we talked about, that the time has come for belt tightening, and especially to bring down the axe on social spending, programs on education, health, extension of unemployment benefits, so on and so forth. So that was one side to it. And the other was, there was a picture that was painted of Congress as sort of incapacitated by a partisanship, you know, that was hurting the better interests, the greater interests of the country. And that what really needed to happen was that you needed to bridge this partisan divide so that Congress could be acting in the interest of the American people. And that's, in a funny sense, when you report the outcome of that survey, that's really, people are repeating back what they've been told. That is, there is a lot of genuine disgruntlement with Congress and with the way in which society is going. But this is taking the form of, you know, why can't the Republicans and Democrats act together to solve this financial crisis? But every element of the way this has been painted is misrepresented. The Democrats and Republicans are not acting in the interests of the people. They're acting in the interests of empire. You know, I gave the example of the military spending. And there is many within the ruling class that there need to be these cuts in social spending. So they're not acting in the interest of the people. And this debate that's taking place, a very sharp debate, is a debate over how fast and how far to go with these austerity measures, with these cuts in social spending. So there's a kind of misrepresentation of what's actually going on, and where people do have this dissatisfaction with the whole state of affairs in the country, this is all being kind of processed through the narrative that's put out through the media, the politicians, and the experts. You know, that one, there needs to be this belt tightening, and two, that the belt tightening should be done in a spirit of nonpartisanship. And that's kind of a sort of a deadly argument, because, as I said, what's being debated out is not in the interests of the people, and these two programs are all part of a larger effort to cut back in the way I've been describing.
Well, you know, one thing that's come out, and I've seen this written about in many, many places, and you actually note this in your interview too, there's a sort of a thing that's being propagated, and I think it's really important what you're saying, but people repeat what they've been told. And in a lot of ways, there's even this thing of a sort of, I don't know, this view that sort of downplays the ferocity of this struggle, this fight in the ruling class, and then, you know, and talks about, well, this is mainly a manufactured crisis. It's meant to take attention away from different things. But you, when I was talking about, you make the point that this is a real, real struggle. You also reference, and I think you've been doing a lot of work over the last couple of years on the changes in the world economy that really is presenting the U.S. with a lot of, the U.S. imperialists with a tremendous amount of, you know, new necessity and real dangers.
Yeah, I think this is right. Again, we have to sort of cut through the fog with this and really pull the lens back and take a view of this debate and this very sharp struggle within the U.S. ruling, because we have to kind of look at this historically, and we have to look at it, you know, from the vantage point of the world economy and what's going on. And when we pull that lens back, I think what we see are two things. I mean, one, the struggle over this debt is an expression of deep problems that are confronting U.S. imperialism. And I'm speaking of the effects of the global economic crisis, that there is a real economic crisis. You know, some of the indicators of that are in the headlines, the volatility of the stock markets. We can talk a little more about that. But there's the effects of this crisis in the world economy. And then there are shifts and realignments within the world economy in the period of crisis. That is, one of the points I make is that after the downturn, a generalized global downturn of 2008, you know, that went, you know, 2008, 2009, that is the financial crisis of 2008, and then in the global downturn of 2009, in that very period, China emerges as the world's second largest economy, and China is not a socialist economy, it's a capitalist economy. So you have this global crisis, you have shifts, power shifts, economic power shifts within this world economy. U.S. power is declining, even as its military power is unprecedented in the history of humanity, and the U.S. has been seeking to compensate for its economic decline with its military strength and with its quest for greater world empire. And it's this backdrop of economic crisis and shifts in power relations that are contributing to real budgetary constraints. In other words, when the ruling class or when the politicians start talking about, well, we just can't spend money left and right, you know, they have their reason for saying that. That is, they want to impose this austerity. But there is real necessity for them to restructure government spending, and there are real limits on their maneuvering room, both internationally and within the U.S. economy, given the state of the world economy. And these are the things, you know, that set the backdrop for a lot of the debates that are taking place. And this is something that hasn't really been well understood. Many progressive and radical people, and friends of mine and other analysts and scholars, have described what's going on just as political theater in order to push political agendas or in order to prevent the rich from paying more taxes. But actually, there's a deep structural crisis in the world economy, and this is forcing, this is compelling the ruling class in the U.S. and this, you know, to restructure government spending and to deal with these very, very serious challenges they're facing on the global playing field of world capitalism.
You know, all right, Raymond, we have, and let me remind people that we're talking with Raymond Lotta, revolutionary communist intellectual and political economist. We're talking about the debt ceiling crisis fight debate, and he has an interview at revcom.us called The Debt Ceiling Debate, Global Crisis and Savage Austerity, and that's in Revolution Newspaper. Now, Raymond, we have time for one more question, and that is, and I think this actually concentrates up a lot, too, because the role of Obama in all this, I mean, I kept thinking about, you know, there's a lot of things that has been said in Revolution Newspaper over the years that you sort of look back and say, wow, that was really prescient, you know, and you're looking at this thing, even what Bob Avakian has talked about in terms of the, you know, the Trump card play with Obama. And you're looking at this, and Obama with the most, you know, I mean, really heading up this whole assault on the people around this and this fight to actually finance the whole U.S. imperial machine to the maximum extent possible and deal with this world crisis they're facing. Obama comes out still to a certain extent looking like the guy who tried, you know, and it's sort of, to me, I wonder, you know, like, what do you think of the role of Obama in all this and what it says about both the mood of the people and the what's going on with the system? What are the possibilities here? Because I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction and anger, even while there's a lot of misunderstanding about what's actually behind this. Can you talk about what you think of this whole role of Obama in this?
Yeah, well, I think you're pointing to some very important phenomena. You know, through the course of this debt ceiling and budget debate, Obama emerged as the leading champion of fiscal austerity, that is, this belt tightening that you're talking about. You know, and he put his grand compromise, you know, that he had introduced earlier in this debate, you know, involved, you know, $3 of spending cuts for every $1 of tax revenue increases. In other words, this was where he was coming from. This is what he was putting over to people. So, again, you know, we should be clear that there's a general consensus within the U.S. ruling class on the need to cut back. As I said, they're dealing with these, you know, global international phenomena, including the role of the dollar, and the need to preserve the dollar is the key currency in the world economy, because that's a source of great advantage for U.S. imperialism. So you have Obama acting this way, becoming the austerity champion. This, I think, is causing a lot of consternation among progressive people. You know, Harry Belafonte, I don't know if you saw this, Michael, or some of your listeners might have heard this over the weekend. He issued a statement over the weekend in response to the budget deal that had been reached. And he said, look, he feels there's this incredible moral void in America, you know, that people's lives are being sacrificed for this. And Obama has become this proponent of, you know, of austerity. He said, you know, this is not what I expected. And he said, this is criminal. He used the phrase moral void.
Wow.
And I think this does capture the feeling of a lot of progressive people. But as I said in my interview, you know, I think that's significant, that sense of betrayal and bitterness. But the question is, where will this go? And I think this really underscores, you know, the importance in this period of bringing forward a vision of a whole other way society and humanity can be. That, you know, Avakian, Bob Avakian, has been underscoring and making this point that there is no permanent necessity to existing conditions. Things do not have to be this way. That we can create a different world. That requires revolution. And, you know, I'm involved right now in promoting the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America. This has been issued by the Revolutionary Communist Party, which puts forward a very inspiring vision and concrete measures for building a new society. And this is what a revolution can bring into being, a society that's not based on exploitation and profit, that is actually organized around meeting the needs of the people, protecting the environment, overcoming the great social inequalities of society, and contributing to the advance of world revolution. We need to have that alternative vision on the terrain. This is a very powerful ideological force. It's an attractive force, and it's absent right now. And I think this is part of the significance of what we're confronting, that there's a sense of disappointment that you're speaking to, and there's a sense of betrayal on the part of many people who had invested their hopes in Obama. But we need to put before people an alternative to this madness, because you can't reform this beast. You can't sort of switch around tax policy to make this beast not be a beast. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something that we need to put before people, the need and the possibility for a whole different way of organizing society and emancipating humanity. And this is what, you know, Avakian's vision of communism, re-envisioned communism, is all about. And this constitution that, you know, that I'm going to be out on the, you know, in school campuses and on the media talking about, is trying to bring this into sharp focus. The world does not have to be this way, and there is a liberating way to organize society, and that will require revolution, and we are building this movement for revolution today and getting that vision out there.
All right, Raymond, we're going to have to wrap up with that, and we'll look forward to having you back around that and around many other things as this thing unfolds. So thank you very much, man.
Great, man. Thanks for having me.
Okay, take care. We've been talking to Raymond Lotta, revolutionary communist intellectual and political economist, and you can get his interview in Revolution Newspaper at their site, revcom.us, R-E-V, as in Victor, C-O-M.us, and the interview is called The Debt Ceiling Debate, Global Crisis, and Savage Austerity. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with P.Z. Meyer, so stay tuned.
For my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the monster mash.
All right, the Monster Mash, and those of you who listen to the show regularly know what to expect now. We've got the rock star of the science world, the man who is adored by tentacled creatures all over the world, Mr. Dr. Rockstar P.Z. Myers, okay, P.Z. Myers, who is the author of the largest science blog in the world, the most popular science blog in the world, which is Pharyngula. So welcome to the stage now, P.Z. Myers. Okay, P.Z., how are you? Big crowd out here.
Wow, yeah, okay, that's some introduction.
I just wish that I had those, the sound of like billions of tentacles clapping for you. All right, P.Z. Myers, who's from the University of Minnesota, Morris, and he's a biology professor. He's got a new book coming out, and that'll be in the fall, right?
Spring.
Spring, okay.
Yeah. Yep,
we're looking forward to that, man. So
let's. Oh, me too.
Okay. and he travels the world making trouble, okay, in a very good way, shaking things up. PZ, we're going to have to jam this in because we went a little longer at the first segment, but I really wanted to talk with you about what's going on with the Large Hadron Collider, and I'd like to talk to you about that in terms of, one, what is it, and what's the importance of what they're doing right now?
Oh, well, of course, I have to put in a disclaimer. I am not a physicist. I'm a biologist, but, you know, I keep my eye on this stuff. It's pretty exciting stuff. The Large Hadron Collider is a super collider. It is generating particles flying at the highest energies under controlled conditions that we can. And the purpose of the collider, of course, is to test the subatomic world, test the predictions of the subatomic world, and see if they actually bear out, if they actually work out the way we expect, and also see if anything new comes up.
Well, they're looking now for this thing that really, it kind of really grabbed my attention. One, just the name of it, right? And it's the Higgs boson, although I'm always having a trouble. And this might have been too much TV when I was a kid. I keep looking at it thinking Hogs Bison, you know? Higgs boson, you know, what the hell is that and why is that so important?
The reason it's important is there's this model in physics. It's called the Standard Model. And what it does is it describes the behavior and properties of subatomic particles like quarks and leptons and bosons and things like this. And so far, the Standard Model holds up pretty well, and it describes a lot of phenomena very well. But it predicts the existence of this one particle. Now, if the Standard Model is true, there ought to be this one particle called the Higgs boson, and nobody has seen it yet. It's a little bit unsurprising because they do predict that it would be hard to see that it would exist for only the briefest moment of time, and that it would require very high energies to, you know, separate it out and generate it so you could spot it.
You know, one thing that I read about that, it really blew my mind, was that they say that they won't be able to see it and that it only travels the distance, a distance less than the width of one proton. What
yes.
The hell, man?
Yeah, so this is something that does not exist on its own very well. It exists in collaboration with other particles. So, yeah, it's kind of exciting that if they haven't found it yet, they get these little hints now and then, and you occasionally see a news article that says, oh, we think we may have found it, and, well, we're not sure yet. We have to analyze the data a lot more carefully, which is what you'd expect with something so small and fragile and short-lived. But, yeah, the LHC is the tool we're using to find the thing. And if we find this, as we expect, what it is great confirming evidence of the Standard Model and says, yeah, the Standard Model is the way it works.
Well, you know, the importance of that, too, I mean, I think there's really this major question here because it's, you know, look, part of this is, I know they're trying to figure out how do things gain mass. And what they're creating at the Large Hadron Collider is they're trying to create conditions as close as they can to the beginning of the universe. And this question of this particular particle and the idea of it gaining mass, and could that be sort of explained the jet, you know, I won't say it, I know the word, I'm not going to say it, all right, Genesis, but, you know, in the non-biblical, completely scientific sense of the term, the beginning of, could this help explain the beginning of the universe? And to me, it's really interesting because there's been people who say, and this is where, and I understand that I was a little nervous about this, but I also know you have like a scientific head, so you are checking this stuff out, even though you're not a physicist. There's a certain thing in here with the scientific approach to things. And there's been this thing of what you're saying is, yes, this could make a huge difference in terms of actually establishing that everything we've known, or in the main, everything we've known in particle physics and what we found out about the origins of matter and the universe are true. Also, there's another thing that comes up, which, you know, then there's arguments that are being made from the other side saying, well, yeah, but you know what? If you don't find it, then perhaps you're completely wrong. What do you say about that? And what does that say? What kind of thinking is that?
Well, yeah, that's standard scientific thinking, is we're constantly trying to poke holes in our own theories. And, you know, we could sit back and be complacent and say, hey, we got this great theory, the Standard Model, it predicts all these things, it works really, really well. We're done. We don't need to do anything more. But we haven't found this one critical piece, this one little element that would tell us that we're really on the right track with the model. And so scientists are going in, and they're testing, and they're testing, and this is exactly what they're testing for, is where are the weak points in our model? How can we get through and actually break our model if we can?
Now, that's an important approach. But here's the other question, is that, you know, which really bugs the hell out of me, which is that the idea that you don't find it, then you have to throw everything out the window. And to me, you have a lot of experience that in relation to evolution and evolutionary biology. You know, there's always these people trying to say, well, if you don't find the missing link, your whole theory is shot to hell, right?
Right. Well, you know, although I got to tell you that there's another twist to this, is, yeah, they're looking for this particle. If they don't find the particle, there's a couple of approaches that the physicists will take. One will be, and this is rather cynical of me, they will say, well, obviously, we didn't have enough energy in the LHC. We're going to have to get a new collider.
Yes, that is cynical, brother.
Yes, and that could happen. Although, you know, they do have pretty good predictions about, you know, what kinds of energies they need to generate in order to see this. So, anyway, it will still be problematic if they don't get it. But the other is, if it doesn't pan out, if it looks pretty consistent that the Higgs boson doesn't appear in their studies, then that's kind of an exciting time, because that says, hey, our standard model has got some deficiencies. There's something wrong here. We're missing some key point in the story. And that will set off physicists going everywhere trying to figure out, what is the missing piece of the story? What can we do to improve the model? And that's always good. That's what we love to hear. And it's the same thing in evolutionary biology is, you know, for instance, one great example is a couple of weeks ago they published a new fossil of this new dinosaur, this feathered dinosaur that's related to Archaeopteryx, and it sort of quickly dethroned Archaeopteryx. It says Archaeopteryx is not the missing link in the evolution from reptiles to birds, which we never thought it was anyway. But what you saw was scientists very excited about this. This is good news. It's more data. We've got more understanding of the base of the evolutionary tree for birds. So finding things that contradict our existing ideas, that's what we live for.
Yep, exactly. And that's exactly how science and humanity moves forward. I mean, this is a very important thing. Now, we're talking with Professor P.Z. Myers, professor of biology at the University of Minnesota Morris and author of Pharyngula, the most popular science blog in the world. Now, PZ, it's been good talking about moving forward. One thing, speaking about that, we're going to slide into moving backward right now. Okay, slippery slope into a really deadly swamp. What the hell is going on in Texas with Rick Perry and his National Day of Prayer?
Isn't that insane? Well, you know, I was actually talking with some people from Texas last night, and they're planning on going to this event. And one thing that will reassure you that made me feel a lot better is that apparently he's got this gigantic stadium that can seat up to 70,000 people or thereabouts, some huge, amazing number. And, of course, the other thing is a lot of the people in Texas who are utterly opposed to this whole idea of calling on God to solve your problems are going. They're going to show up there. So even if he's going to have this small audience in a large space, and a large number of the people there are going to be people who actually oppose him.
Have you looked at the lineup of the fools that are involved in this?
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell people a little about that? I mean, this is like Hitler's cabinet, right?
What's that?
This is like Hitler's cabinet, right?
Oh, yeah. The one is they have somebody coming from the American Family Association who's going to be there. And this is an organization that has just recently been declared a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. This is the kind of people they're going to have there. So, no, it's not reassuring.
One of the things, actually, I know there's somebody in there that you've actually written about and that's going to be there is Brian Fisher. Tell people a little bit about him.
Oh, Fisher is bizarre. Fisher is a right-wing maniac. He's strongly against immigration. He has said all kinds of horrible things about you know, evolution and science, and also all those brown-skinned people, not a good guy. And yet here he is. He's going to be speaking there. It's just bizarre that they're so clueless to the kinds of toxic personalities that they're bringing in.
Well, actually, one person that really intrigued me is Mike Bickle. And you have to give this guy something. He's the founder of, you ready, the International House of Prayer, where you can go in and get a short stack, okay? A short stack of fascism, okay? I'll take the short stack and put the smiley face on it, okay? It's amazing. It's really amazing. You know, one of the things I was very concerned about, though, and one of the things in terms of the group that they're bringing together and, you know, this sort of coalescence of all these Christian fascist movements, and especially in relation to, you know, the kind of thing that's going on in the world now with the Tea Party, with the elections coming up, all the stuff that's going to be going out there, the tremendous dissatisfaction in society. And what we've seen before is that when these kinds of people do get out there and mobilize their base, it is a very dangerous situation, including their ties in with the U.S. military. You know, this is like a
very dangerous thing. And sometimes what happens in these kinds of events, and I'm hoping this will happen here, is that it brings the cockroaches out into the light, and you see exactly how awful they are. You know, Brian Fisher is a guy who he's made these pronouncements about how, for instance, the Nazis staffed their armies entirely with homosexuals because gay people are the only ones savage enough to do the evil things that the Third Reich did. Which, you know, when you just hear that, you just say, wait a minute, this guy this cannot be.
I don't know whether to laugh, gasp, or cry at that. That's just like, you know, or stand up and start beating the microphone against the wall. This is incredibly intense, boy. And it's scary, though, that these people do. I mean, look, you think about these things, you know, the Left Behind books, all these things that, you know, they're always, it's easy to laugh at them, but there's a real dangerous current out there that we've got to really, really pay attention to. And that's why I wanted to talk to you about it, because I knew you'd be.
There's an undercurrent in Christianity that is extremely scary, and it's this apocalyptic element. Mm-hmm. And it's very strong in fundamentalist and evangelical Christianity now, where they get all hot and bothered and excited about the idea that the world is going to end, and they want to do things to bring it out. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, a lot of times what they do is stuff that's utterly futile. I mean, there are these people trying to breed a perfect red heifer because the Bible says that will cause the end of the world, and I encourage them to do that. But I would discourage them from getting their hands on the button to start nuclear war.
That's the thing. And actually, whether they get their hands on it or a Dick Cheney clone gets his hands on it and has them as backing and sort of the sort of foot soldiers for the horrors that can be brought down on this. That's the thing that's really scary too. So, PZ, we're going to have to cut it short, but I'm going to have you back for a much longer time on the second week of September. So clear your calendar, brother. All right?
Yes, I will be here.
Okay, great, man. PZ, thanks a lot, man.
Very good.
Talk to you again soon. Bye now. All right, you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We were just talking with Dr. P.Z. Myers, biologist and associate professor at the University of Minnesota Morris, and the author of the most popular science blog in the world, Pharyngula. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Mr. Fish. Right, the emperor is naked and everybody but him knows, but actually there's one person sitting here with me today, right across from me, who actually has been ringing the bell and telling everybody the man is naked, the whole system seems to be naked, and he's not going to stand there and let it just parade down the street unspoken to and unopposed. I'm talking about Mr. Fish. Mr. Fish is joining us today to talk about his new book, his debut book, Go Fish. And that song, by the way, you heard was Everlast. No longer House of Pain, but he's got his Love, War, and the Ghost of Whitey Ford. That was the album it came from. Mr. Fish is Dwayne Booth in his other world. That's the last time I'll call you by that name, though, okay?
Yeah, it means nothing to people.
Yes. And it means even less to you, okay? All right, Mr. Fish, what the hell's going on with you? this book, I have to say, is incredible. I mean, I don't always say that, but it's going through this, I was blown away by, and having had some familiarity with some of your work, but seeing this collected together, it's absolutely brilliant, and it plays such an important role in the world today in terms of piquing people's consciousness. I'm kind of serious though. You know what? What the hell's going on with you, man? You say you're not an editorial cartoonist, but you've produced this book. What are you and what are you doing? Quick, I want to know. I went to Catholic school. Trained by Sister Marie Admirabilis. I know what's going on.
Right. I guess that one of the purpose of what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to break down people's private internal concept of how the world works, and I'm trying to get rid of their public understanding of it, if that makes any sense at all.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't. Good.
yes, of course it does. Well, you have an approach, actually, and you said the thing that disassociates you from other cartoonists is that, and just looking at the work, is that you address political problems that are in the culture, but not from a political point of view.
Right.
You know, and you like to respond to tragedy emotionally.
Right.
You know, so can you talk about that a little?
Yeah. What I find really deplorable about politics is that it removes the human element from the equation. It doesn't consider the glorious messiness of the human heart, you know. For example, if you just take as a real straightforward example, if you look at when Obama was running for the presidency, many of my progressive friends, they were terribly excited, African-American guy running for the presidency. Yet when his stance on the war wasn't exactly progressive and when his support of Israel wasn't exactly progressive, it was okay to have the excuse that, well, he has to do that to get elected. And again, that's fine. That's a logic that they said was fine. A lot of people believe is fine, but to me, it's BS because you cannot have that excuse when you're going for an office that is going to affect the world. You really have. It should be much more about honesty and less about a strategy on how to get power.
Well, when you talk about politics, because I look at your work and I think it's really very political in a broad sense, you know, in the sense of the fate of humanity and the planet. It's not political in the sense of one political party versus another, the Democrats versus. I think you do astounding work and really important in relation to stuff with Obama and the Democrats and the Republicans. Right. You have some great stuff that one where about it'll be okay once we switch the head out.
Right.
It's great. You know?
Well, that's one thing too about with politics. Again, I mean, I see it in a lot of political commentary. If you're going to talk about politics and stay in that camp, if you're a political cartoonist, which I don't think I am, I think a lot of political cartoonists will draw a cartoon that points up something despicable about the Republicans, and automatically they think that it's you're supporting it's proving something virtuous about the Democrats because you say something bad about the Republicans. It keeps the conversation very surface and not at all integral to how a human being really thinks.
Well, you make the point in one of the things, either in an interview I heard or in one of the essays you have in the book, you make the point that a lot of political cartooning is, and this is what you're saying, is really just arguing an existing establishment point of view.
Right.
And you had a thing, and I found this really intriguing because we probably grew up in that same little cut of land. I grew up in Southwest Philadelphia where we watched right outside the oil refineries where we watched the blue and green lights at night, and we never realized we were being poisoned, thought they were great shows,
right.
And ran behind mosquito trucks sucking in DDT.
Exactly, right.
You know, so my
youth.
But, you know, this whole thing here, you said you once toyed with leaving the country.
Right.
You know, and you decided to stay.
Right.
And so you could get infected and fight better.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I just think you understand, if you say the disease, which is a man-made disease, is so terrible, the tactic for understanding it and convincing people about how terrible it is to allow yourself to get infected by it. Then you can become an expert. Mm-hmm. And then people cannot say that you're, you know, if you leave the country, it's just like, oh, you know, you couldn't take it. You might as well be a Frenchman. you know, for all the connotations that that has to some Americans, you know.
You know, I was going to open this segment up with a thing from Fish Tank Ensemble, which I thought, well, okay, there's a time, that, but then it would have been perfect because the title of the song was Itty Bitty Snitty Frenchman. we would have had a, oh boy, pal, I'll never be able to go to Paris again. Well, one of the things you talk about in here in terms of your influences, you talk about Kurt Vonnegut, which, mm-hmm. you know, I think anybody who's sentient in the world today has Kurt Vonnegut as somebody right. you really, really admired a lot, you know, and drew a lot from. But you do a thing where you say he talked about protesting wars was not unlike protesting glaciers, and that the weaponry of artistic expression was roughly equivalent to a custard pie being dropped from a step ladder 6 feet high. Right. Don't tell that to Rupert Murdoch, okay? And you took that as a call for artists to play a huge role in society, not to step back. Explain that.
Right. Well, certainly we're, you know, all evidence points to the fact that we may be doomed. That's a given to me. But there's no reason why we can't go down swinging. And again, I mean, reality is much too complicated for anybody to be able to predict with any certainty at all. So if you follow your heart and you follow your basic instinct to want to stay alive, then you're going to act in accordance to that passion. And you're going to try to be a humanitarian first before you're anything else. So yeah. So I mean, even though it looks dire and looks terrible, if you stay true to yourself and to, you know, your love of the tribe, then you're just going to, you're not going to bow down to what you think is despicable.
You know, it's interesting when you just use that phrase, your love of the tribe. You know, one thing I really got in some of the writing that you have in the book, as well as through some of the, you know, all the work, all the artwork that you've done. And it's interesting because I'm a little older than you.
Mm-hmm.
You have a 60s sensibility in a good way, in a very
right.
good way, which really intrigues me.
Right. That's the other book. I actually, when I was growing up, I wanted to be Angela Davis. When I was 7 years old, I wanted to be Angela Davis. I had a little, I had a carved peace sign that I had on my desk, and I wanted to stick it to Whitey when I was a kid. Because there was something that was so powerful to me about being able to be political. She was political because of what she was, not for just what she said, but what she was. And she couldn't help being an African-American woman, which to me was just like, embrace what you are and don't let anybody try to put you in a box. And for me, that was like, that's a hero. That's somebody, because she had no other choice. She was herself, and she recognized the trueness of her nature, and that was political to me.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Mr. Fish, the author of, well, his debut book, about his debut book, which you should not miss. It's a really incredible book. It's called Go Fish, and it's from, I never get the name, Akashi Press?
Akashic Press.
Akashic Press.
Yep.
Really great book. And check this out, all right? It's really an incredible, pick up the book. Let's talk about this, and it fits in with what you were just talking about. You make an interesting, I thought, a very interesting and very important point, and we have about 7 minutes, and I want, so just as short as you can, because I want to talk about a couple of works in here. You make a point about really being viscerally opposed to unanimity as the determining factor and the end goal of everything, right. And I think that's incredibly important in terms of your artwork and your whole consciousness that you bring to that.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, isn't it a problem? I mean, you think about this, because your works, I mean, look, we'll start talking about this. With that in mind, we'll start talking about this. Your work, the stuff that you do on Israel and on the Palestinian people, subtle but head-slamming, because you just don't see that anywhere.
Right.
You know? And there's an epistemological approach there of not seeking balance or, you know, it could be this, could be that, or let's all just agree, and then that'll determine what's right. You take a very sharp stand about what's right. And then go for it.
Right. Well, like you said at the beginning, I mean, it's really an emotional response. You know, I can't allow, the politics of the situation to convince me of the logic of power oppressing people. You know, there's no real justification for it. It can't be argued, I don't think.
Well, you know, it's heavy, though, because I'll tell you what, there's one in here where you have a picture of a concentration camp, which is a classic photo almost, you know.
Right.
And you have all these terrible, terribly emaciated and obviously torture beyond any realm of morality in the universe that you could think of.
Right.
And you have them holding signs like they were Palestinians, calling for the
right.
end of the suffering, the attacks on the Palestinian people,
right.
and all this other stuff. And that, what kind of response did you get for that thing?
I couldn't get it published anywhere.
Really?
Yeah.
Ah.
I mean, it went up on my site, but, yeah, I mean, it's again, it's just if you just take one step back and not try to understand stuff with the political slant on things, who but the Palestinians? Who but the Israelis that were released from the concentration camps would have a greater empathy for what the Palestinians are going through.
And I thought the other one that really, really grabbed at me was the one with the pile of dead Palestinian bodies, where you said
right.
The Palestinians were hogging the light of the
right.
moral ground from the Israelis and their
right.
you know, their experience of genocide.
Right.
The dead bodies piled up. Really, really
yeah.
incredible.
Yeah, nobody has a right to claim all the agony in the world.
Right. Now, what are the ones that you don't get printed? What are they? I mean, are there a lot of them?
Well, I mean, the Israeli cartoons are generally ignored. Unless they're not as loud as the one that you described, mm-hmm. then it's okay to slip that in. But I still get hate mail no matter when I publish those mm-hmm. to this day, and it shocks me. I don't know what people are waiting to see happen before they say, you know what, there is a really horrible situation that continues to go on, and it's something that we should all really, really be aware of.
How have people, the other person that you really go after as a phenomenon, I think, but also as the occupier, the emperor who is naked, you go after Obama full
mm-hmm.
tilt. And in ways
right.
I find so damn refreshing, man.
Right.
It's so important to be out there today because that cat is the Trump card that the system played.
Right.
And everybody drank the Obama-lade. All
right.
these people drank it. And to this day, there's still a lot of agonizing over, whoa, is he really selling us out? You know?
Right.
And you have gone after him for quite some time
right.
in really good ways. Controversy around that?
Yeah. Yeah, again, right when he was elected, I was getting, again, a lot of hate mail about just lay off, give him a chance, as if the office of the presidency was some sort of Gandhi-like position that he was going to be able to express, you know, peace, love, and understanding, which to me, it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, you're the head of the largest, most barbaric regime in history, and you're going to be, peace, man.
right.
I'm down with you, bro.
Yeah, that's not the gig.
Yeah. Any subjects that you don't do, that you shy, do you ever censor yourself?
No. Again, just like I began this, our conversation, you know, when you're alone and you're having a private internal conversation with yourself, which is what you have from the very beginning, you start to realize that you're terribly honest. You can't be offended. You can't offend yourself with dirty words, for example, if you say them inside your own head. So that kind of honesty that you have, that internal dialogue that you have, I'm just trying to bring that out more into the public because it's more of a reflection of what we are as human beings than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, do you find, you know, I write in addition to doing the show and other things, and
right.
one of the things that happens to me is, you know, I mean, and I really enjoy it, but I also find that, you know, I sort of feel a little, I don't know, sort of confined in doing that.
Right.
And I really have to stretch a lot of times. Do you ever come up on pieces where you say, even though it's not censoring yourself, but you say, you start to put it and you think, well, wait a minute. what am I doing here? I can't do that.
I'd never do that.
Wow. Interesting.
Right. Yeah.
That mosquito truck got to you, brother. in a good way, in a
right.
very good way. The book is Go Fish by Mr. Fish. It's an incredible, How to Win Contempt and Influence People. I thought that was really a great, great title.
right.
You know, what's the response you're getting to it?
People love it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people really like it and they do find it, refreshing, you know. They say that as I can hear them sort of hiding it under their mattress after they get it, and but people seem to really like it, and it's been really fun to you know, talk to people and get them all fired up with me.
Well, you know, I mean, it's really even you know, and I want to tell people that this is there's some that, you know, you can look through and say there's just no subtlety here, but and really there is, because
right.
when you look at this, my wife was looking at it with me last night, and she was saying some things like, and in particular that one with the, you know, there were a couple where she had to really look at the drawing and think, whoa, wait a minute, what is that? And there was one in here that is not offensive in any way to anybody, couldn't be construed as offensive to anybody, but is really thought provoking. And we got 1 minute, so we got to rush 10 seconds on this. The chessboard. Really incredibly brilliant piece. I love that.
Right.
And you can tell people what it is.
It's just a great, well, I'll say it's great. It's a representation of the power structure in the United States. On one side, it's all the pawns lined up. And on the other side, it's all the power pieces lined up. And what makes it positive and optimistic is that there's one pawn that's stepping forward.
Mm-hmm. And that is really good. And that's a message through your work. I think you issue a clarion call in a really weird but really great creative way, and one that I'm really welcoming here. I'm really happy to hear. Mr. Fish and his book, Go Fish, How to Win Contempt and Influence People. Mr. Fish, welcome to the show, man, and thanks for coming in. I really appreciate that. And when you do another one, get in touch.
I will indeed.
All right. That brings us to the end of another show. But before we go, there's something I want to read to you from Bob Avakian, and it's from his new book, Basics. All right. And this has to do with the whole theme of today's show. So check this out. Oppressed people who are unable or unwilling to confront reality as it actually is are condemned to remain enslaved and oppressed. I want to thank all of my guests today, Raymond Latta, P.Z. Myers, and Mr. Fish. I want to thank my board op for today, Tamika, and my production assistant, Henry Carson. And most of all, I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in and encourage you to keep on tuning in, because if you're not listening, this show can't do what it needs to do. And that is to dig in, to understand the world in order to change the world, for all of us to be able to go out and change the world. All right? So if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslade@redfuture.com. And again, I encourage you to do that. Send me your ideas, your comments, your suggestions, your criticisms. Again, that's michaelslade@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a song from Sunrise Above. And the song is called The Human Cost, and it's from his album, Every Day I Wake Up on the Wrong Side of Capitalism. And damn, don't we all know a little bit about that? Waking up on the wrong side of capitalism seems to be the story of our lives so far. So check this out, and I'll talk to you again next week.
As I went rolling down that ribbon of highway, this land is my land, isn't what I say. Signs that I'm passing last, no trespassing, cash rules everything, which means I'm just a target. Profit to God, that's king on the market. Bring on the rocket launchers that knock us all unconscious. 30,000 children dying every year who don't have to and still get killed. That's why I ask you, how many mothers cried today? How many looked up at the sky and prayed to try to find a way? Yeah, how many children died today? How many workers gave their lives away so you could live it up? Huh? How many mothers cried today? How many looked up at the sky and prayed to try to find a way? Yeah, how many children died today? How many workers gave their lives away so you could live it up? Nature is the mother, labor is the father. Capitalism's a rapist, they're straight raking it all in they wallin'. The top 5% has got a lot of rent while I ain't got a single red cent, so I'm dead bent. Liquor in my liver's like religion in my brain, helping me maintain, cause I can't withstand the pain. Drain my blood like vampires, my man fired for being minutes late, got him in a mental state. Man, I hate the way they got it set up, gotta get away, but not a vacay. Revolution is my revelation, never devastation. Patient, my own a hurt, mine in the dirt where my great-grandpa died at his work. How many mothers cried today? How many looked up at the sky and prayed to try to find a way? Yeah, how many children died today? How many workers gave their lives away so you could live it up? Huh? How many mothers cried today? How many looked up at the sky and prayed to try to find a way? Yeah, how many children died today? How many workers gave their lives away so you could live it up?